Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Did You Know? I am your host, John C. Abercrombie. Our primary discussion today is on the Greensboro, North Carolina sit-ins. Excuse me. I think these took place in 1960. And there's a lot of misinformation about sit-ins. Please excuse me. Having a little problem on this end. Personal problems, hopefully not technological problems. But what we try to do is bring you history that has taken place. And many of our listeners today, particularly if they are old enough, probably remember the situation when it happened. I believe the year was 1960, and we had four college students from North Carolina A&T sit in at a lunch counter demanding service. They wanted service at this public lunch counter. At that time, the nature of many stores were different. F.W. Woolworth was a five and dime, which I guess the closest thing we have to that today is the dollar stores. But one of the features that they had that I have not seen in a dollar store is a lunch counter. Some had a lunch counter and a snack bar. And what's the difference? A snack bar, you had to stand up and gobble your food down or take it with you. A lunch counter, you could sit down and have a small meal. And they were open to the public, with the exception that most did not allow blacks to use the lunch counter. We see it, and it is difficult for some people to recognize the amount of progress that has taken place in these 50, 60 years since that time. And I say it seems like that is an awful long time, but in many respects, that's all that we've gained. And I'll try to explain it to you. Now, many of you are listening on your devices, and there is a number that's also available. I'll give you that number, because I don't intend this to be just a lecture where I talk. I will entertain questions, comments, suggestions. You can disagree with me. You can agree with me. We are trying to open a conversation on a level that allows people to, in an adult manner, discuss problems. Many of the nuances of a sit-in were not well known, even at the time. And when I say this, I'm not just putting this on one race or the other. Most of us were in the dark about many of the circumstances surrounding it. When we look at, and let me give you this number, because I'm going to open the microphones earlier than normal, because I may have to cut the recording short because of personal health issues on this end. But that number is 646-668-8217. I intend to open the microphones the first time at 4:30. Then we'll probably close them and then open them again. But if you are listening on your device, even your cell phone, I cannot see you on my dashboard and therefore cannot open your microphone to allow you to make comments or ask questions. I encourage you to do so, but if you want to do that, the way to do it is to call number that I just gave you, 646-668-8217. I mentioned our primary topic was the Greensboro sit-ins. Greensboro is a fairly large city in North Carolina. What we sometimes get confused with or don't ask the questions about or don't even attempt to find out is, were these the first sit-ins? No, they were not the first sit-ins, but they were the first picked up on national television and broadcast around the country. This gave them quite a bit of significance because what we saw shortly after that was sit-ins all over the country, primarily in the South, because this is where most of the open racism was shown. They had, and I don't remember the snack bars as such, primarily because my mother ran a restaurant and I didn't need to go downtown to grab a hot dog or a hamburger. I had access to my own. I could put whatever I wanted on it. And so therefore, it was not that appealing to me. But I understood the fight. I understood what was going on. And I understood probably better than most the danger that these people were putting themselves in. And some people will say, what danger are you in just sitting at a lunchroom counter? Let's take a look at what these people had to do before they were accepted to be able to be demonstrators. They were trained. They had many hateful people calling them every vile name they could, dumping things on them, milkshakes, coffee, you name it, food, pie, everything was thrown on them. They were cursed. They were called everything except a child of God. Even cigarettes were put out on them. Did that result in arresting of those people? No. They were free to do what they wanted to because that's the way the system worked. The system worked as it was designed to work, and it was designed to work against those people that were seeking for the service of having a cup of coffee and a piece of pie. That's all they wanted. And it would have been, well, I don't know, because I am on one side of this issue. I cannot say necessarily what happened or what should have happened on the other side of that situation. But I saw it as a step forward. But I also saw that these people were taking a great problem on their hands because they could be beaten, probably were beaten. And that doesn't mean just by the people protesting them being there, but also at the hands of police. Because from an early, early age that took place before the 60s, I have seen men, women, and children beaten for reasons that I still do not understand today. I knew it could happen. I knew nothing would happen to the police. In those days, the primary police officers were white, all white. Now, here in Spartanburg, South Carolina, we had two. But they didn't have the authority to arrest white people. If a white person committed a crime in their presence, they could call a white officer who would then decide whether or whether not to arrest that person, that white person. We could arrest black people, but we could not arrest white people. Imagine growing up in a situation like that. Imagine knowing that you could be abused. Your First Amendment, all of your constitutional rights could be violated. And just as today, there's no problem because we have qualified immunity today. You want to understand qualified immunity? Look at my blog site, amazingblackhistory.com. There's a search bar. And type in qualified immunity, and it'll bring up two or three posts on the subject. And this worked against us. It worked against us in so many different ways. There was a time and a joke that went around, and a person from out of the area had hit two pedestrians and had knocked one into halfway down the block, and the other one had come through the windshield. And as the joke goes, the officer on the scene was going to write the individual that was knocked half a block down the road with leaving the scene of an accident. And the one that had busted through the car window because the car had hit him was going to be charged with breaking and entering. At the time, I thought that that was a very, very funny joke, until I began to realize that all too many people were being charged using that as a criteria. This is the way the system was designed to work, the way that it has worked in the past, and the way that in many cases it still works today. So we see these four people taking matters into their own hands. They knew what they were getting into, but they understood that it was worth it. The fact that it was broadcast on radio and TV all over the country shows the extent to which it had taken place. Now, we've had men and women fight in many wars. And as we talk about this, I want to remind you of a couple of upcoming events. On November 7th at 7 p.m. in the Spartanburg Public Library, 151 Church Street, I will be speaking on blacks in the military. Some stories very close to home, some stories very close to us. And we will look, starting at the Revolutionary War, World War I, World War II, and some other wars, what we have done that has not been recognized. Therein lies most of the rub. Most people don't realize what has been done of a positive nature because we do not discuss things in full. We don't give the true story. We don't give the whole story. And for that, we are left with people who have seen what they have been exposed to on radio, TV, and the like, in the movies, and in the like. And that is definitely not a positive image compared to what has been done. So we look at the people in Greensboro. We look at people that have applied those same principles in other cities. And some of them have been savagely beaten for wanting to have the same rights and privileges that you, any other American citizen, has. I don't think that that's out of bounds. I think we should have it. But it is not what has been done in previous years. So we had four men, and they undertook this march. It soon swelled to over 300 people. People wanted freedom. People wanted rights. Excuse me. And most of the times that we see what black people are like, it's a caricature. It is not what people want. It's not an honest depiction of them. Most depictions were of white actors in blackface, making fun of people, just because they wanted the rights and privileges of a United States citizen. We've seen it for years. The system was designed so that we did not get what was fairly and honestly ours as United States citizens. When you can imagine that you can go into a store, you can spend your money. There were some things that were absolutely outrageous. If you wanted to buy clothes, you could not try them on in many places. No. If you bought something, a hat, you could not return it. And so you were at a distinct disadvantage. Many times, the downtown was the shopping area because we had to work every day. Normally, that was limited to Saturdays, one day out of the week. And it was usually an all-day affair. So when you see this, you go down, and sometimes you want a cool beverage. Sometimes you want a snack to tide you over. You couldn't do that. You even had neighbors or other people that you could maybe call a friend. Generally, when you went downtown, don't expect them to speak to you. They didn't want other people to know that they even knew you, that they spoke to you. So it was a very terse communication, just being downtown. Many stores had policies that as long as there was a white person to be waited on, they would be waited upon before you. You have elderly people standing there. Some kid walks up and they service the kid, take care of his purchase, his needs, whatever, before they even recognize you. When they recognize you, it is generally not a very pleasant thing that they are communicating to you. I mean, it's barely civilized. And in many cases, I would say it is not civilized. And so we look at what is taking place and we understand that this is the way the system was intended to work. This is why they had these snack counters, so they could charge you full fare for minimal to no service. So the Greensboro Four were very, very courageous. They were not the first to perform a sit-in, but they were the first to be put in the spotlight by national television. What is so wrong with wanting to have a cup of coffee and a slice of pie? They made it seem as if you had violated the tenets of the world, that, oh, this was the most horrible thing a person could do. We had many people saying outsiders were stirring things up. They were not stirring things up. Sometimes they were the one keeping the lid on the pot to keep it from erupting. When I tell you that in 1960, these were not the first demonstrations, there had been other demonstrations, but they had not been broadcast across the country. When we saw the Selma to Montgomery march, we were treated on television for the first time, the snarling dogs, the horses trampling over people, all in the name of maintaining a separate but, quote, equal services, facilities. They were certainly separate, but in no way equal. In no way equal. I remember many of the things that I put up with that I probably would not put up with today. I remember I just wanted to have contact so that I could play sports. And when I went to the doctor's office, there was a large waiting room, current magazines, aquariums, and what have you. I was set in a closet with a pop machine, brooms, mops. This is what happens. This was the separate but equal facility that was shown to me. I wouldn't have put up with it. I would have gone without the contacts very, very easily. But we did it because that was the only option that most of us had. The only option most of us had. Everything that signaled that you were a second-class citizen was taking place. If you rode a bus, get into the back. Pay full fare and get into the back. And if the driver wants to be rude, no problem. That's what you deserve as an American citizen. You sit in the back and shut up. This is the way things were designed. I don't think it fair. And when I could bypass it, I did. I didn't want to put up with the foolishness. Because either you are subjecting yourself to severe beatings, and these would happen. Drivers on buses had almost law enforcement capabilities. If they came to you on the bus and said, get up. Now, you might be an 80-year-old man or woman, and a 13-year-old child comes on, white child. Not only would you, but anybody on that row of the bus. Now, we know that there are two seats on each side. But you couldn't even be on the same row with a white person, so you had to get up. Say you go to town. You're feeling faint. You need some water. You can't go to a lunch counter and get a cup of water. What they had was refrigerated water, chilled water. For white customers, if they did have a fountain for you, it was room temperature bubbler. I mean, it was better than nothing. But it was intended to show you that you were not a first-class citizen. Why do we go to all these depths to do that? I think it's because of competition. Competition. Competition for jobs. Because in many cases, and I've seen this myself, I've been in situations like this. But as a single person, you don't have the backing behind you of entire groups, people. And some people think that you're just crazy because you even bring up the idea at all of you not being qualified to be in charge of a crew, generally an all-black crew. So they hire somebody to do it, and you have to train that person because you, your unqualified self, know more about the job than anybody else in that plant, including your supervisor's supervisor. These are things that we had to put up with. I applaud these four people in Greensboro for doing it. And the fact that so many others within rapid succession did the same, seeking dignity, seeking recognition of themselves. Let me give you this number because in about 5 minutes, I will open the microphones. And while my primary concern is the Greensboro Four, that is by no means all that we will talk about. Excuse me. As I am getting towards that, I want to mention two dates to you. One is November 7th at 7 o'clock in the Spartanburg Library. I will be talking about blacks in the military. Come one, come all. Because many, there is a particular lean to that discussion. Because we're going to talk about some local heroes that most of you do not know, but should know. And this is what is one of the things that has taken place in our history, is that when we do something good, nobody is told about it. So we think that we have never done anything positive, because everything that we have seen on radio, TV, and in the movies shows us in a negative light. This is why we talk about these things. It's not to place blame on anybody. Now, the second one, before I forget it, will take place in the middle of January at the Cowpens National Memorial. And I will be speaking of blacks in the Revolutionary American War. And I believe that is going to take place several times during the day. I do not have I think it's a 2 or 3 day event, but we will be there. We'll be prepared. We'll be prepared to handle questions that may come up. And I'll give you more information on that as time comes near. But it's going to be at the Cowpens National Battlefield. To those of you that don't know, there was a great battle at the Battle of Cowpens. If you go to downtown Spartanburg, there's a statue to General Daniel Morgan. And he pulled off a procedure, a double envelopment procedure, that is very well known by military people. And it worked very, very effectively. But we don't know about that. And we don't know about Americans in the American Revolutionary War. There are several that we'll be bringing up. And I hope that you will come and ask questions and maybe bring up some others. One of the stories that I had heard that I am still researching is that William Washington, George Washington Cousin's life was saved by a slave at the Battle of Cowpens. Now, whoever thought about anything similar to that? Because we think the only people that fought in that war were white. It's not true. When we talk about the daughters of the American Revolution and excluding blacks, they were wrong. Because some of the very soldiers had black children. And we make it a racial thing when it does not have to be. So we have done things that need to be discussed. This is why we're doing this. That number, again, is 646-668-8217. I see that we have dropped one of our callers. I see Marshall is on. We'll get comments from him, very faithful listener. I hope that some of you that are listening on your devices get curious enough, get crazy enough to tell us what's on your mind. Did you ever have an idea of what and why we were sitting in at lunch counters? Who did you talk to about it? Did you talk to a black person? More than likely not. But then you had strained relationships between black and white. Strained relationships. You expect black people to spill their guts, but you don't want to tell them how you came about. Why? Because in some cases it is embarrassing. But we have to realize, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, that merely not talking about a situation does not resolve it. It drives it deeper. It allows it to fester. And festering in this situation is not good. Because many of those things that happened in 1960 are still present today. Why? Because we did not talk about them. We did not bring them up. They harmed the psyche. They harmed the unity of a country when we can't talk about them. We get to a place where people say, no, you cannot talk about history because it ain't worth anything. In other words, you're saying I'm not worth discussing a major problem with. Is it because you don't think I have the intelligence? Do you think I don't know how to act? What is the problem? Tell me and we can work that out. Don't tell me and we will pass a problem on to our children and our children's children. So we have come to that point. I'm going to open the microphones briefly. We'll take comments and we'll go back into our discussion. But remember, if you have questions about other subjects, feel free to bring them up as well. So we now have open microphones on two of the people. Marshall, are you there?
Yes, sir, Mr. Abercrombie. How are we doing today? Yes, sir. How
are
we doing
well
today?
Hope you are too. We're doing well.
Yes,
hope
doing
you are too.
Yes, sir. Just fine. Enjoying this beautiful weather outside today.
Oh, man, it is gorgeous.
Yes, yes, certainly gorgeous. Yes, I was just talking to our good friend, our brother D. We call him the white man, and that is Greg McKeefe. And he was telling about he was telling us about his trip up in North Carolina, where that they was making molasses at the molasses grinder mill, where that the mules
okay.
was pulling the I forget what you call it, the grinder that grinds up the cane and makes the juice come out of it. And he
right.
made in time that he could buy some of the molasses from the mill. And we're going to go up there the day after Thanksgiving up there to something else, another event that they're going to have, where they're going to have mules and the people will be 10,000 people expected to show. And they were going to be selling the mules and the horses and the wagons and all of this type of thing in North Carolina somewhere. We're going to go up day after Thanksgiving to that event. But well,
outstanding,
yes, sir. Mostly we, last night, the NAACP had its Freedom Fund dinner, and it was really, really awesome. It was like the BET Award. Reverend Jesse Jackson's son was there. Plus the young man from Silicon Valley, I think District 17, be in the news a lot. He was our keynote speaker for the West Spartanburg Green. And it was really an awesome time last night. Everybody was dressed. And I asked him, is this part of the BET Awards here tonight? It was really, really awesome. And my brother and I, we got to sing him a couple of songs because we supposed to have been out of there at 9 o'clock. It was like 9:30 before we got out of there. So we had a wonderful time. But I also brought up to our good friends about you being at the Spartanburg Library on the 7th at 7 o'clock. And somebody said, and people be coming up with all kind of excuses, talking about, well, ain't that the day we vote? Yeah, you're going to vote that day. They ain't got nothing to do with 7 o'clock that evening.
Yeah, just come on down. You're already in town.
Yes, yes, yes. It's a day. Everybody's out and doing not doing anything. So come on out. And I told them about what you were going to be speaking about. It was going to be the blacks in the military. Yes, what you're going
okay.
to be speaking about. Yes. So we just listened to
in
you.
In January, we're going to talk about the American Revolutionary War specifically.
Right.
And I think there'll be several performances there. We'll have a large tent, and it's capable of holding, I think, at least 1,000 people. And
great.
So we should have good crowds all that time. I'll let you know the specific dates and times so that you can learn about your local history.
Right. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
But
we
see,
also,
most people thought that was a bunch of foolishness when when these college kids were sitting down. But they were demanding rights that everybody else had that we should have had.
Yes, yes. Demanding our rights. That's all we're doing. Yes, somebody got to
You were probably around when they did the. You were probably around when they did the sit-ins in Spartanburg.
I was working with Thorin Leggins, the black electrician there, and he and I left the job we was on and went uptown to it. So I had the chance to see some of the demonstration that was going on uptown at that time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There was. Mm-hmm. Certainly
did. People didn't realize how much danger those people that were sitting in those chairs were up against, because
that
you could
exactly
be attacked.
Right. Yes, yes, and by the police, the same way they're attacking us today. So if they attack you today, at that time, you can imagine how you could have been attacked. But those kids stood up for what was right and stood up, and somebody's still going to have to stand for what's right. And that's why we do what we do. Somebody has to stand.
Yes, that is true. We have
yes.
another caller on. I don't know if they have anything that they'd like to add. But if you do, this is the time to do it. You don't have to speak. We're not trying to force anybody to speak. But if you do, it adds to the commentary.
Mr. Abercrombie.
Yes.
You talked about the fact that you did not, or you were not interested in black history as a youth and over the years, even as an adult. From that experience, do you have any suggestions of how we might encourage our youth and get them interested in history?
Yes. I'm glad you asked that question, because I absolutely hated history growing up. Now I'm going to tell you about a story that started me to thinking about black history in a different light, because we used to have Negro History Week. And during that week, we would always talk about George Washington Carver. And I got to the point, I said, if this is all you got to tell me about, then save it for somebody else. I heard about that last year. I want something new this year. And so I didn't realize that we had made the contributions that we did until, by chance, I was in California. And I ran across a family, or the legacy of a family, that at one time had owned the original site of Sutter's Mill. Sutter's Mill is where gold was discovered in California. As we looked further into that case, I learned that there were prosperous families living in that town. And what was so important to me is that when the discoverer of gold, a guy by the name of James Marshall died, that Pearlie, one of the children, had dug his grave. And that when Pearlie died, he was buried in the city cemetery. And that was very strange to me, because when I had left Spartanburg in 1962, they weren't even putting the obituary of black people on the obituary page, which I thought was highly disrespectful, highly disrespectful. And I began to find out, and one of the things that I found out within the last couple of weeks is that the matriarch of the family, a lady by the name of Nancy Ross Monroe Gooch, is actually a sister of a lady by the name of Harriet Ross Tubman. So I find that her sister is Harriet Tubman. But they did very well. In fact, in the newspapers there, they were described as having one of the grandest homes in that town. Now, I had been told all my life that basically all we did was pick cotton. That's all we were useful for. And I began to look at more and more. And I think when we expose our children to this, it not only makes them interested in history, but it allows them to dream a bigger dream because they know that we have done that. When we have spent years and years watching TV, Bonanza and every other cowboy movie that you think of, it's like the West was all white. It was not, because one of every four cowboys in the West was black. It's been distorted to keep us from having an interest. It's been distorted to keep us from knowing what has taken place. When we look at the town of Centralia, which is located in Washington State, right now it's a town of 10,000 people or so. It was discovered, founded by George Washington. Not that George Washington, by a black man named George Washington. And now that has been rectified. We go to great lengths to make sure that people don't know what we have done. And that town would not have survived if it had not been for the generosity of this black man for all of the people that lived there. When we start looking through history, we find that we are there. This is why I do the series at the library, and you to speak about once a quarter. When we have programs like this, I want to know what you want to know so that we can provide it, so that we can get ourselves and our kids interested and know that we're just not here just to be here. I want us to know the good, the bad, and the ugly. Most of us don't know how harsh slavery was. We knew that we worked all day, but we didn't know that we didn't get a single penny from it, that we had no land, we had nothing to show for the centuries of work. We go into sharecropping, and we don't understand the evils of sharecropping and what happened. The owner made much money, and because we hadn't been taught to read, write, and do numbers, we were cheated every way but Sunday on what has taken place. This is not just information for black people, but it is information for white people as well, because most of them don't understand it. And when we look at it, we're not trying to place blame for slavery on every white person, because there were many, many white people that did not agree with slavery. There were many that fought, many that gave their lives for the freedom of blacks. And we talk about that as well, because it is a myth that's been put on all of us that we don't realize what we have done, what we've done together. Our military involvement has been for two victories. One, on the battlefield. Yes, we wanted to win. And two, we wanted citizenship. We wanted everything that came with that citizenship. We wanted the rights that came with it. We realized that our schools were substandard because districts were spending anywhere from 2 to 10 times as much on white students as they were on the black students. How is that separate but equal? Separate, yeah. Unequal, yes. Not equal. And unless we understand what is taking place, the position that we're in, we're not going to make the progress that we should be making. And this is why. Explain to our children, explain to everybody what has happened. We need a new beginning. We need people like the listeners that we have on this show that are willing to understand what's going on, that will speak up when some of this foolishness is going on, that we haven't done anything. We've been doing it from time and time immemorial. When we look at Denver, Colorado, for example, there was a gentleman there, Barney Lancelot Ford, who was an entrepreneur and built a building back in the 1860s that still stands in downtown Denver today. Anybody know that if they didn't go searching for that? This is what happens. He was not the only one. And there are so many, but they're covered up. We have to talk about the situations that came up. And I'm sure there are people listening that need to call this number, 646-668-8217. I'll give that again, because anytime you call on Sunday, this is how you get in touch with us. This is the way that we do it. Now, if you call in, you can call in up to 15 minutes early and be there when we start the broadcast. Now, we're going to close the mics for a little bit. I'll talk a little bit further about this situation. We'll open them back up. I appreciate all of you, your questions and your comments, and I want others to join us. Yeah, it can be intimidating sometimes calling a show, but we're not here to embarrass anybody. We're here to provide information for you. It is not just a show for black people, because there are many white people that don't realize that they had relatives that were in the fight. Most of them don't want to search because they think that slavery was bad, and it was bad, and that every white person is related to a slave owner, and that is definitely not true. It is not true. So while you're worried about the baggage that may come up, you need to understand that facts have more power than ignorance. We're trying to ward off the ignorance. We're trying to shine light on the problems. I want you to, when you call in, realize that you can ask almost any question, and if we don't know an answer, we'll try to find one. If it's a subject of interest to most people, we may even have a show on it. Now, at this point, I'm going to close the mics. I'm going to open them again at 5 o'clock, which is, what, 12 minutes from now, and see if other people have joined us. But it is that significance of what took place in Greensboro, North Carolina, where four men who had discussed the life and disgust of being a black person in America found the courage to sit at the counter of Woolworths. Now, part of that is in the Smithsonian. Part of that lunch counter is in the Smith Park. The Smithsonian part is in another museum. Now, we think it doesn't take courage to do that, but what would you do if you were sitting down protesting the fact that you couldn't be served and somebody was cracking eggs on your head, somebody was dumping a milkshake, somebody was dumping a hot cup of coffee on your head, somebody was kicking you, beating you, and you knew that if you retaliated in the least, that you were going to be beaten and jailed. Beaten and jailed. You say there is no evidence of it. I say there is plenty of evidence to that effect because I have seen it. I grew up with it. I spent almost 30 years as a law enforcement officer. But I have seen men, women, and children being beaten by the police for reasons that I still cannot explain to this day. It took courage to do that. It took courage to march on the Selma March. All of the actions that took place took tremendous personal courage. Personal courage. These men stood up or sat down and demonstrated that we believe that we deserve something here. We deserve it, and we're going to demand it, and we're going to demand it until we get it. We look at many of the slave owners as if they are pious people. They are next thing to God. Now, most of them have decided and taken vows before God that they would be faithful to one woman. And yet and still, they have more black children than they have white children. In every other society, or in most other societies, the status of a child follows that of the father. But we come along with a separate one saying, no, it follows that of the mother. And that allows them to have children and to sell and profit from their own flesh and blood. I can't tell you how vile and evil I think of a person that can do that, their own child. Now, we were talking earlier, as Marshall talked about, the molasses being made. Many slaves in America, and particularly in South America, were put into that industry. And it was a dangerous industry because it was extremely hard work. When you were working with the molasses, you were working with hot stuff, and many people were severely burned in the process. But we also don't realize that we eat tons and tons of white sugar. What's bad about white sugar? Many of the nutrients have been removed. But also, and what's funny as heck to me, is that most people don't know that the process was developed by a black engineer, Rilo. His father was French, but his father gave him an education. He trained as an engineer in France and brought that knowledge back to America and was able to make refined sugar. And we gobble this stuff down like it's life-giving. A little bit's good, but we do way, way too much of it. But that is a process of a black man. How many people knew that? We didn't just pick cotton. We did everything we were capable of doing. And we had lots of people that understood this. That's why they didn't want us to be educated. That's why they didn't want us to know numbers, because they could cheat us. Many of the sharecroppers had to buy stuff at the country store owned by the owner. So what had happened is nothing except they were openly making money off of the slaves in ways that they had not been able to before. So they were selling them seeds that they should have been splitting 50-50 and making 30 to 60% off of the seeds to start with. And it continued like that for everything that they got from the store. And it's not like you could find another store and purchase there, because your script was for his store, which means that he had a ready source of profit for himself. Does that sound like the fairest system that you can come up with somebody who is supposed to be your 50-50 partner? Whether that was written or not, they did it with the intention of finding a way around it. This is why I say that when we talk about a system operating the way it was designed to operate, that's the way it was designed to operate, so that you can make much, much money. Even the best of situations took advantage of disadvantage of people. When I would go to town, when I would walk to town, it was both a joy and a sorrow. Because one of the places that I had to pass was a white juke joint. And it seems that on Saturday, every white person had to go there and get drunk. And it appears that the smallest little banny rooster in the place would be the one to come out and harass everybody going around. Made them feel big, I'm sure. That is the way the system was designed. You couldn't call law enforcement because you were being hassled. It wasn't going to work in your favor. More than likely, if anything happened, you would be beaten and taken to jail for some offense that was cooked up. When we see this happening in our history, when we look at Viola Desmond, for example, and although Viola Desmond was not an American citizen, she was a Canadian citizen, She went to a movie. They didn't have the laws written as such, but she had asked for a seat downstairs. They put her in the balcony. She couldn't see very well from up there, so she went on the main floor. And she was brutalized by the police and charged with tax evasion. Tax evasion? What in the world does that have to do with going to the movie? Well, it seems that in that difference in the price of the seat upstairs and downstairs, there was 1 penny of tax that was involved. 1 penny of tax. She was roughed up, had to go to the hospital. She was fined $26 for this 1 penny indiscretion. She had asked for that seat downstairs. And to make matters worse, the fine was only $20, but $6 went to the owner of the theater for reporting her. Canada discovered this many years later as her sister took a class in a Canadian community college. Canada apologized to her and gave her a free pardon. Now, what's a free pardon? A pardon says you committed this error, and so we're going to wipe it off the books. A free pardon says you never should have been involved, never should have been arrested in the first place. So it goes much deeper, much further. And we have people today who have blemishes on their record. When we look at Opal Lee, O-P-A-L-L-E-E, Claudette Colvin. Claudette Colvin was a juvenile, and about a month before Rosa Parks, she had been charged with the same thing. They did not take her case because at the age of 16, she became pregnant. And we know that the victim is victimized in many of these cases. So she was not there. Now, we look at equal dispensation of justice. Just last year, at the age of 83, Claudette Colvin was released from probation. So for all these years, she has had to, and in later years, she has had to go to her probation officer in a wheelchair because that was the only way she could get around, refusing to give up her seat to a white person on a Montgomery bus. The system is not fair by any stretch of the imagination. Any. I want you to review Dred Scott. I want you to look at some of the other cases where it is clear and plain that the system does not work properly. It works as it's designed. And when I say not work properly, it takes advantage of some people. That's the way it was designed to work and where it all too frequently does. So we see this. We see this time and time again. Not fair. Not fair, folks. Because if you were in the same situation, I am definitely sure that you would find it completely different than if you were being victimized. You would not allow it to happen. But because you don't know it, you can't put in your 2 cents worth. This is what's wrong, folks. What I'm going to do is it's 5 o'clock at this point. We've got roughly half an hour to go. I'll see if there are any additional comments, questions, or suggestions. Marshall, are you there?
Yes, sir. Still here, Mr. Carver-Crumley. Yes, sir.
Any questions, comments, suggestions?
that's finding out from you some of this good information that you're getting, some that is that we as African-Americans certainly should know about ourselves. The more we learn about ourselves, I think the better we would feel, and then that would add on not to the better that you feel, it would be the better way that we would conduct ourselves. I think we would conduct ourselves as better people and as productive citizens in this state and in America, that if we just knew about ourselves. We're not just someone shot in here from the moon or somewhere. We African Americans. We have nothing to be ashamed of, especially our heritage and our history.
No, we do not. Yes. I was thinking of Hazel Johnson, and she was the first black female general in the Army, and she wanted to be a nurse. But they didn't think that black people could be nurses, so she had to persist. So we're just not talking about one or two people. We're talking about a whole bunch of people that had to overcome a whole lot of stuff in order to achieve success. But we have. And I think that we are being completely unfair to our adults and our children when we don't let these stories come out, when we don't understand what is taking place. Most people do not understand that these people had to show that they could put up with the foolishness that was being dumped on them, that these almost uncivilized beings that were dumping food on them, hitting them, beating them, calling them everything but a child of God, that they could even take it. Most people wouldn't have taken it, but they understood it. They understood that they couldn't fight back, but yet they took on the challenge. This is what the American dream is all about. We take the challenge, and we overcome whatever there is to overcome. So, yeah, I think it goes there. I think it is so deep in our history that we need to talk about it. And I'm telling you, not every white person was a bad person. I won't say that again. Not a white person was a bad person, because you talked about Greg McKeith's day. And I got a note from John Fowler today. And other people. There's some good people out there.
Certainly, certainly. Some of my best friends are white people. One that I co-mangle and mangle with in the county that I live in, most of them are white people. And I run into people every week. I'm talking about good people willing to help you, especially if they see you doing something.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yeah.
We have another caller. Did you have anything to express? The lady that asked the question earlier, do you have anything else? If not, that's okay as well.
No, thank you for your answer.
Okay, you're very welcome. And I hope that you join us and ask additional questions, because I want to encourage people to call into the show, people that agree and people that disagree. This is where change starts, and I appreciate you most highly. What I'm going to do at this point is I'm going to terminate the broadcast, because I'm feeling a bit under the weather. And I think we've gotten most of our information over on the Greensboro sit-ins. They took place, they rapidly came up all over the country, because people realized that it was wrong, that things could be done about it. They are not the first, but they're the first to gather the nation's attention. There's so many things that we could do if we would only speak up. We get into a discussion about black history. And because we don't know anything, we get bulldozed by those that think that they know something. Here, we learn the truth. Here, we learn the research. Here, we learn how to search and do much more than we ever thought that we could. It's always been my pleasure to come to you on Sundays, 4 o'clock, with Did You Know? And with that, my friends, I thank one and all that have joined us. I hope others of you will develop the courage to call in. We don't want to embarrass you. We want to hear from you. We want to learn. We learn that by having discussions. We don't have to be disagreeable to disagree, because that's one of the values of humans. That's one of the values of Americanism. We listen to each other. We benefit from each other. And some of the stories that are coming up are fantastic. And in February, we'll be posting every day in honor of Negro History Week. And let me tell you this about Negro History Week. It wasn't a week set aside where we could show everything that we've learned. We were to study Black history all year long and come together and share during that week what we had learned, and then go learn some more and come back and share some more. So this is where it came from. This is what we intend to do. This is our mission. And so when you have those things, bring them up. I had somebody relay a story to me secondhand, thirdhand. This gentleman was out, and his kid wondered why this black man had on gloves, because they'd never seen black skin before, and how embarrassed he was that his kid said something. That was an opportunity to teach something. But most of us have not been taught anything because our parents and our teachers didn't know any better. This is a chance for us to correct those types of insights. So again, it has been my pleasure to be with you. I look forward to being with you again next week. I'm going to take care of myself and hope that you all are blessed. I ask that you share the link to this program with others. Come back. Join us. Bring your questions. Bring your comments. Let us know how you grew up so we can let you know how we grew up and we can resolve the differences that we have. Be blessed, my friends. Be blessed. And tune in to Did You Know? Next week. I am your host, John C. Abercrombie. Be blessed, my friends. Be blessed.
God bless you, Reverend Brother Abercrombie, and we're praying for you. You're better.
Thank you. I appreciate it more than you know.
Thank you, sir. Yes.